If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Captain!
Not here.
Captain! Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair.
We have engaged. The Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery, the Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. What's The Greatest Generation, you might ask? It's our other Star Trek podcast. We're embarrassed about it. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
How you doing, Adam?
I'm wearing an oversized belt buckle. I'm wearing my best frilly blouse.
You look great in that. I feel like if you go on late night wearing that frilly blouse, you could really set off a fashion trend.
Yeah. I don't want to be a pirate.
I thought I hadn't seen this episode, and I'm still not sure if I'd seen this episode, but like there were parts of it that I was like, maybe I have seen this before. Did you experiencing anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this ep is like Star Trek zeitgeisty enough to where I think we've seen clips of it for decades.
Yeah, I guess that must be it.
And maybe from those clips we're able to piece together some kind of story out of headcanon.
Now, people listening to this might think that this is the first time we've reviewed a original series episode, but they would be wrong, Adam.
That's right, Ben, because it wasn't too long ago that we gave a look at Mirror Mirror.
You, of course, I think, watched Space Seed to prepare for our Greatest Gen Con tour. I did not do that because I don't prepare. It's not my way.
I like to surprise you sometimes on stage.
Peppering in a little bit of actual knowledge.
That's how you keep it fresh. Keep the relationship fresh by doing something a little different.
Sometimes you tie me up.
Sometimes I poop on you.
Only when there's a glass coffee table in between us do I allow that.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
but we did that Mirror Mirror episode, and that is in the donor Boco feed. And
it was such a good experience.
Yeah.
Wanted to go back to that well, right?
We were surprised at how much we enjoyed watching an original series episode.
So playing with that good feeling house money, we're doubling down on Mud's Women. I think we're going to have that problem a lot. We're going to be talking about the episode title, but it could be inferred that we're talking about the women themselves.
Right. Yeah, this is one of those episodes where the title gets said in it, you know?
Right.
Like a character says the eponymous phrase, and the possessionness of these women that is implied in the titles turns out to be far more literal than I had anticipated.
Isn't that the truth? Well, Ben, we're talking around the episode without beginning the episode. Maybe we should just do the thing.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
Well, you must be asking me about the original series Star Trek Season 1, Episode 3. That's crazy. This was the third episode of the original series, Ben. It's Mud's Women.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Those Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Third? I had seven. Wait, it's number seven in Netflix.
I'm looking at Memory Alpha. It says Season 1, episode 3. I think we got to trust Memory Alpha over Netflix.
Well, they certainly have more descriptive episode capsules.
This episode starts in media res. Ben, it's one of our favorite ways to start an episode.
Mm-hmm. I love to get into some nice media res.
Yeah.
One of my favorite places to hang. Yeah, there's a pursuit, unidentified ship, doesn't have a identity transponder, so they don't know who this ship is or why they're running away. You know, it's one of those things where, like, if a cop walks into a park and somebody, like, drops everything they're doing and sprints away, that cop probably has probable cause to detain the person.
Yeah. Yeah, and in this episode, we've been watching a lot of Deep Space Nine for our other program, Ben, and this episode announces right away that it is of superior special effect, because this chase scene is really good looking, and all of the ship comps from the exterior look glossy and nice.
Yeah, this is CG that replaced the original model work, I believe.
Yeah, it looks really good.
They did a nice job. It's got they were, I think, very faithful to the intent of the original artists.
Yeah. So this mystery ship is trying to flee through an asteroid belt. It appears to be kind of a suicide-style mission because no one on the Enterprise thinks that that's a survivable way to go.
Yeah, they say that it's an asteroid belt with a Schiller rating of 3.5. And that's, just to give you a sense, that's like 2 habanero peppers.
You know, that's the kind of hot sauce you have to order through the mail.
Yeah.
You're not going to find that in the stores.
Yeah, if you see that the tamper-proof packaging has been messed with, return it to sender.
When your hot sauce comes in it with a Schiller rating of 2.5 and also comes in a medicine dropper style format, that's pretty bad news for your next few days.
Yeah, your firehouse chili is really going to cause some problems.
Outstanding!
Speaking of sauces, Adam, did you notice that there was a big spill on the floor of the bridge in this scene?
I did. It was hard to miss. That stain obviously predates the lids on beverages policy that they had on the bridge going forward.
Yeah, Jim Kirk had some of his tea Earl Grey hot there on the handle of his big chair and knocked it off or something.
Yeah, no cup holders on the bridge.
Yeah, you would think that they would have some accommodations for a beverage. Nobody ever eats or drinks on the job in Star Trek, do they?
I guess. Well, I mean, every time you see that depicted, something awful happens. It's like, what was her name? Was that her name Gomez who spilled her coffee all over the captain's chest?
Right. Yeah. She never recovered from that. She was gone. I mean, the next episode. Do you know who this other deckhand is? There's a guy in Chekhov's seat. I guess maybe Chekhov hasn't arrived yet.
I called him just Helmsman Buscemi. I think if he were to do the 23andMe, like, it's a pretty thick branch into the Buscemi family tree.
Yeah.
Super
really
thick,
does
Ben.
Give Buscemi that thick branch. The deal with these asteroids is that they are going to pulverize the ship that they're chasing, and they're like, hey, we didn't want to kill you, we just wanted to find out who you are and what you're up to. And so they have to extend their defensive fields around this ship, but it's kind of taxing the engines. Like, they keep talking about how the engines are overheating, which is a very, like, 1960s, I broke down on the 405 on my way to the writer's room kind of idea. The Enterprise is really, like, is really taking a beating. All the circuitry is burning out, and these lithium crystals keep burning out, causing little kind of brownouts on the bridge. But they manage to hold the deflector field around this mystery ship for long enough to beam off first one survivor and then three more.
Yeah, the one survivor identifies himself as Walsh, and he is he's dressed as summertime Santa Claus, Ben. he's got the frilly blouse, he's got the big belt buckle, he's got a twirly mustache of the kind that you'd find in one of your better cocktail bars.
Yeah, he's got like a kind of a boat neck undershirt that really shows off his wharf puffs.
Yeah, wharf puffs in full effect.
He's one of those guys where he stops shaving is a bit of an arbitrary decision.
Just based on his mood.
Well, it's like I guess, like there's just hair on his neck, you know? Like it's not, that's not his chest, that's his neck. And I guess at a certain point, you don't want to just have to shave your entire neck if you're that hairy, but maybe you should, is all I'm saying.
I have a dolphin's amount of body hair, Ben, so it's hard for me to imagine what that would be like.
Yeah, but you also do such delightful water tricks.
Yeah.
People that come to Greatest Gen Con and sit in the front three rows are always delighted when you do a flip into the pool and splash everybody.
That's what we call the first couple rows at every Greatest Gen show, Ben. It's the splash zone. But but it's mostly due to our prodigious drinking.
Just where is it I find myself?
He's playing coy. You know, he's like, I didn't answer and I didn't beam over initially because I didn't know who you are or what you wanted. And they're like, well, yeah, like there's systems in place for establishing these kinds of things, like transponders.
It's that frustrating situation where in an emergency, you're not getting a straight answer. Like the clock is ticking on this other ship and there are other survivors there and they can't get a straight answer out of this Walsh guy. Ben, low-key, one of my favorite parts of this scene is the framed Starfield print in the transporter room. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of like the Kronos Euros poster that's on the wall of any Euros place. Like like having a framed picture of the thing that happens in the room that you're in is meta funny to me.
A solid bit of business, yeah. Do you think Scotty gets to decorate his own transporter room?
I mean, if he did and this is his personality, it's disappointing.
Do you think O'Brien got to decorate his transporter room?
Without a doubt.
No decorations? I don't have time for all that frilly kind of thing.
This is one of those scenes, Ben, where an asteroid punches through the other ship, and it happens right at the time that they're beaming off whatever survivors they're trying to scoop up. And it's another opportunity where no one beams blood. I really want to see that at some point in Star Trek.
One of the beams materializes just meat.
Not a thing in the 60s, not a thing now.
Yeah, well, I think even more than now, back then they were pretty worried about showing too nasty of images on screen. But what they're not worried about is showing a lot of skin.
Yeah, I guess the ship that they were chasing was a Dillard's or something, because three fembots get beamed aboard and they are fully decked out.
Yeah, they get beamed aboard in a tableau, like they're in poses. One of them is facing away and you're like, oh, that's weird that she's facing away. But then you realize she's just facing away so that she can do a dramatic turn to camera.
Right. I'm not sure that one of them is wearing something designed to be clothes. Like one of them just looks like a blanket.
Yeah, she's got like a throw that you might put on a couch as a pop of color.
God, that it's like that reference just reached through the earphones and grabbed me directly, Ben. You just described my life. I have a couch just like that.
Yeah? No
and
kidding.
And a blanket just like that. Both of which I had no choice in deciding.
Yeah, your office in your house is kind of a corner of a room that is used for other day-to-day activities.
Yeah, it never used to be that way.
Mine is a second bedroom, and I have a couch in here as well. And my wife insisted that I get an accent pillow for said couch.
So, yeah, I mean, a black leather couch without any other adornment telegraphs a lot of things.
Something else going on in here. Not the image I'm trying to send.
No.
The production crew of Star Trek, the original series, legendarily rented every ProMist filter in the city of Los Angeles, California, to shoot this episode, Adam.
Just stacked on stacked on stacked.
There are so many close-ups of these ladies with the, like, gauzy pro-mist effect on the lens. And it's really kind of distracting because they cut back and forth a lot between the men and the women, and they are clearly going for very different effects on both of them. It's like, it's something that, like, in old movies, you do get the star, like the glamorous close-up of the female lead from time to time with the Vaseline rubbed on the front of the lens. And it's not distracting when it is like one show-stopping shot just to like, oh, this woman just walked in and she is a bombshell. But in this, it's like cut, 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 cut. And it's like girl, male crew member, girl, male crew member, girl, male crew member. And it really just like breaks the spell that they're trying to cast, you know?
Yeah, and there's no... I mean, it's a product of its time, right? There is no act subtle at this moment in TV history. Like, you must look like you have an extremely painful erection.
Yeah.
And when they pan across Scotty and Spock and Dr. McCoy, like, they all look like they've had one for longer than 4 hours.
Yeah, he's like, call me Boners McCoy. I have to go to my own six bay.
One of the funniest lines of dialogue in the whole episode is like Kirk radios up to the transporter room and he's like, how many did we get off? And in my inner monologue, I was like, that's a really difficult question to answer at this point in time.
Oh, fun, Adam. That was a nice little punch up.
Yeah.
yeah. Just Spock is less under the sway of these ladies, but like Bones and Scotty are entranced in a way that is pretty troubling. Like, it seems like there's more at work than just pretty ladies.
I get the feeling that early season one Spock is far looser than the Spock that we get in later seasons. He is he's very chill. He's not cold Spock.
Yeah, he's groovier than I remember Spock being.
Yeah.
The commander of the transport to see you, Captain.
When Walsh is asked about these three ladies on the transporter pad, his answer is not to the affirmative with regard to if it's his crew. He instead considers them his cargo, which is probably the first warning sign about about Mudd's intentions here.
Yeah, the warning signs, you know, the red flags are begin to come fast and furious with this guy. He walks these ladies down the hallway and the camera just lingers on each one of their butts as every male crew member stops what he's doing to leer at them.
There's a choice that gets made in this episode quite a few times is in a lot of these tracking shots, they're shooting through something in the foreground, often a mesh, like a metal mesh, like a corrugated thing.
A lot of chain link in the original series Enterprise.
I wonder if that's about obscuring the build quality of the set carpentry or whatever. Like, if you look at homes built in the 60s, you're not going to get a good seam between pieces of wallboard. Maybe that's the same deal on the set. They're trying to cover up how contemporary the build quality might look. You don't shoot through that corrugation when you're getting those bridge scenes, though, because that carpet stain is in full relief.
Yeah, you might have... Yeah, if this entire episode was shot through screens, we might have not noticed that, so...
We have been waiting for someone worthy of our attention.
Who are you?
Those Klingons?
There's a real A story, B story thing going on here, Ben, right? There's the three girls and Walsh, but there's also the depletion of the lithium on board. They've cracked their crystal, and it's a cause for concern because the crystal is the power unit that the entire ship runs on.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a ticking time bomb situation with the ship. If they don't replace these crystals, they're going to be in big trouble. And they don't appear to be able to radio up for help from anyone. Like, Kirk brings Mudd and the girls into his ready room. His pretty immediate connection with Eve, who is, you know, the one of the ladies in the pink dress. I don't know if we get the other two ladies' names, do we?
Yeah, we do. It's Eve, it's Magda, and it's Ruthie. But Eve is sort of like the lead girl of the three. She has a personality that is different from the other two, and she also is given far more story than the other two.
Yeah, she seems to think for herself.
Yeah.
in a way that the other two do less of.
No decipherable reading on females.
And that's a real problem for everyone involved.
So Mud is trying to explain away why he, you know, flipped the table over and ran out of the room when the Enterprise showed up, and also trying to cover for the fact that they damaged their ship quite a bit in rescuing him. And Kirk, like, the second the women leave the room, Kirk kind of gets back to business and announces to Mr. Walsh that he's going to be confined to quarters and that they're going to have a ship's tribunal about what went on here.
There's always been a kind of superhumanity to James Kirk. And the way that that's on display in this episode is that all the human men on the ship are totally transfixed by the women and powerless against them. But it's James Kirk that somehow can resist their charms.
Yeah, like wrinkled sweatshirt Buscemi that's in the Chekhov seat is basically useless.
Yeah,
like,
he's fucked
even
up.
When the women aren't in the room, he's like, oh my God, they're so pretty.
One of the parts that's not supposed to be funny in this ep is Sulu like joining in that fraternity. Like, oh yeah, I noticed too. Like, oh no.
Almost goes without saying because of when this was made, but like the amount of heteronormativeness in this is kind of mind-boggling, you know?
It's hard to conceive of a way it could be more heteronormative than it is in this episode. Like,
yeah, it's like...
they colored all the way to the line.
Yeah, this gets a gold star in the coloring book rating system.
Right.
We get a lot of scenes about, you know, like how, like, we really cut back and forth, you know, Scotty and Spock talking about what big trouble they're in. Then we get a scene with Mud and the ladies, and there are two security guards who seem like not quite as flipped out about these ladies. Like, it's a little bit inconsistently applied how crazy these women make men. These security guards, for example, are able to stand in the room and not make fools of themselves. But I guess to the extent that they do, it's because Harry Mudd is very obviously having a conversation with these women about all of the lies that they are telling. And he keeps slipping up in like some of the most boneheaded ways possible.
And Harry Mudd has only one volume, and it is speaking to the back of the theater.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
This actor's got a lot of charisma.
He's great.
You will deal.
The idea that Walsh slash Mud comes up with is that, like, he's very quick on his feet, right? So as the situation changes, so too is Mud's mission. So, like, having seen that the Enterprise needs these crystals and they're headed to Rigel 7, the story with these women becomes, well, he's a guy who sets these women up with single men. And what better place to do it than on a mining colony that is full of single men? This is going to work out great for them.
Yeah, he gets this information at the end of his tribunal where it is revealed that he's been lying about his name, that he has a pretty thick rap sheet, which the computer reads out at length.
Questionably successful psychological treatment. Is this another part of it?
I noticed there was conspicuously no mention of his fairly antagonistic role in the war with the Klingons, but...
Rambo First Blood Part 2 style combination of races, of genetic makeup.
It's a hell of a combination.
No acknowledgement of the fact that he killed a space whale.
Right.
But this, I like that the computer is able to detect, it's like a lie detector and a computer that lists all the facts about him.
They're sort of deposing Mud in this scene because, I mean, he's actually committed a number of crimes. The idea of just anyone driving a ship through a transportation lane in this area of space is problematic. And I love all of this, like, inside baseball spaceship stuff. Like, you can't operate a ship without a license, for example.
Yeah.
Like, there are a number of things that he's guilty of and that he has to be deposed about, and that's what this scene is for, except the computer acts as kind of a lie detector, and all of Walsh's answers are deemed lies until he finally admits that he's Harry Mudd.
It's kind of sad that this episode turns the Enterprise into sort of like a CHP motorcycle.
Right.
Like, sir, do you know how fast you were going? License and registration. Sir, this license has been suspended.
Have you seen this boy?
They're just writing him a ticket, basically.
Yeah, it's strangely an administrative bit of business here.
But at the end of this scene, like, the life support starts to burn up the circuitry, and it has to be switched over to battery power. So, you know, a bunch of crewmen come in to discuss the details of this with the captain, and the fact that they're heading to Rigel 12 slips out in this discussion. And when everybody leaves, Mudd is quite delighted to have a new scheme and a new miners to sell these women to, because lithium miners are legendarily rich in this world.
And legendarily horny, I guess?
I guess so.
It's during this kind of interregnum, like as they're on their way to Rigel, that the girls split up and they have interactions with different members of the crew. Ruth is the first one. She walks into Dr. McCoy's six bay and is kind of slinking around in there, and she walks in front of one of his...
Yeah, you don't have to say slinking around. They all slink. Yeah. None of them move without slinking. Yeah.
She makes the mistake of walking in front of Dr. McCoy's Two Dots brand medical scanner, and it starts flashing one dot and then two dots in a way... I mean, anyone who has one of these Two Dots brand medical scanners will tell you, not a great sign.
Yeah, he's kind of like playing two different distracteds against each other. He's distracted by the medical scan and distracted by her beauty, but he can't decide which is more distracting. Like, he's very much not himself, but he's distracted from his own distraction.
It's like if you're fucking, but the room is on fire. Like, which is the thing that you're there to address?
Perfect analogy, Adam.
This is fine. And so is that.
Eve lets herself into Kirk's quarters, and they have a screen-mediated conversation.
Yeah, this version of Starfleet definitely predates the locks-on-doors version that we eventually get down the road, but not really.
Yeah. Which version are you thinking of? Because I can't think of any.
Yeah, I can't either, to be honest. It never happens.
Yeah. I mean, people have, like, overridden a couple of times on Deep Space Nine.
Kirk has clearly been jacking it, because Evie's powers are no match for his ability to resist them. Another weird thing happens here, though, is like Evie is, as you were saying, all the girls slink, but Evie kind of lets the mask fall a little bit and breaks character. She's like, I thought I could seduce you, but I don't think I can do it anymore. And then she just sort of bolts.
Yeah, I mean, she's saying like she actually does sweat Kirk, but she's so stressed out by the circumstance she's in that she's like unable to access her real emotions almost.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's an effortful thing happening with all of them.
Yeah.
In order to like maintain this gauzy beauty that they have.
Yeah. So she heads back, and the room that the girls and Mudd are staying in, they have like a big group conversation, and Mudd is super excited because there's three miners. They are single, fairly young dudes, and they mine lithium, so they're rich. He says their lithium crystals are worth 300 times their weight in diamonds and thousands of times their weight in gold. So apparently the abundance of gold and diamonds is still an issue at this point in history.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Remains to be seen whether or not these lithium crystals are blood crystals. We don't necessarily see how they are extracted from the ground.
Yeah. Jaimon Hansu is not down there.
Three miners on the whole planet, huh?
Yeah, weird, right?
Boy, can you imagine what the roommate situation is like there? Not good. It looks like there's like two huts.
They keep them pretty spread out, too. So maybe like Jerry is a real ass and they don't want to be near him.
I could see that.
I mean, it's basically revealed here that Mudd is kind of a pimp and is selling these women as wives.
Yeah, he sure is.
Like, are they there of their own volition at all? Or are they Like, it seems like they're kind of excited about the idea that there's single dudes, right?
The trouble with how these characters, well, one of the troubles with how these characters are written is that they have opinions, but only about one thing.
Yeah.
Instead of their entire lives, their primary focus is the thing that will be revealed later.
Right. Like, their utility as women is also like their highest aspiration as women. Yeah. And both of those are extremely low thresholds.
Mud manages to get his hands on a communicator, and this is crucial because it allows him to communicate with the Rigel miners before Kirk does. So Kirk thinks that he's going to be able to set up a deal pretty quickly. And so as they reach orbit, they're like, all right, let's get a conference table in here. Let's get some snacks. Let's start doing some business because we need these crystals before our air runs out. But the problem is that once the miners show up, they're like, yeah, we're actually here to meet up with Mud and trade crystals for women.
And Kirk, to his credit, is offended by this idea. Like, he's like, no, like...
He's ready to spend money.
Yeah. I have a pocketbook here. Let me cut you a check. And they're like, sorry, sir. We'd much rather take a look at these babes, these Mud's women.
Yeah, and their effect on the miners is exactly what we've seen from the rest of the episode. The miners are transfixed, and there's no talking them out of this deal.
These women, you don't got to sell them. They sell themselves.
And the deal, as stated, is like, it's women for crystals, or you can get fucked. Like, that's it.
Oh, and we should say, because right before this scene, we have kind of a weird reveal where we cut back to the room that they're all staying in, and the ladies have gone ugly.
I thought they were just tired, Ben.
They've got, like, mottled color. They've got, their hair is messed up. I mean, like, their hair's not so messed up. They still, like, you know, all they need to do is run their fingers through it and they'd be back to normal on the hair. But they also have very splotchy color and they, like, look tired and they feel terrible about themselves. Harry Mudd is tearing the place apart looking for something. And he eventually finds it, and what it is the drugs that he's been giving these women to make them vastly more beautiful and attractive than they naturally are. We're seeing them in their detoxed natural state, and then they take the drugs and they go back to being promist, stack filtered.
Yeah, and like the vibe is definitely strung out, isn't it?
Right, like it's hard to tell whether they were going for strung out or like they're also just mopey when they're not
right
on this drug.
Yeah, it doesn't take very long for the drug to take effect, and through a little bit of camera intercutting, they are beautified back to normal.
Thank goodness, Adam.
Yeah, get those filters back on the camera. The scene also like it doubles down on Evie's trauma. Like she's not happy to be taking these. She is at this point even a little bit resistant to the idea of taking them again. She seems to be kind of a holdout.
Yeah, she's not as on board with this. And I mean, like, her position is kind of hard to put your finger on, right? Like, she doesn't, it's more that she just isn't okay with the entire situation than any particular part of it. Like, and I think that's actually kind of a true thing to be portraying, like the extent that these women are chattel. It's like it's an outrage on every level, and she is resisting it sometimes and not others, because sometimes like an institution you live within is hard to resist like 100% of the time.
It doesn't take much effort to pivot this story into like a perfect mate style story with right. Just like a line or two of dialogue. It kind of fixes that.
Yeah.
Not that the perfect mate wasn't problematic in its own way, but...
Yeah, but let's put a pin in that and talk about it when we get to the end, because I was kind of surprised where the episode ended up.
Yeah, you, me, both. So the tension here is they need the crystals, and they aren't going to be able to get them, because it's girls for crystals. And so Kirk has to beam down to Rigel with a Dustbuster club to renegotiate with the miners, and they sort of beam into a party situation.
Yeah, the miners have put on some yacht rock and they're hanging out with the ladies. They have all kind of paired off. I sort of wonder Like, what if one of the miners had been particularly attractive to two of the ladies, or vice versa? Like, what then? But they all seem to have agreed, like, this one with this one, this one with this one.
Yeah, I mean, speaking from experience, Ben, it's tough. Tough spot.
Yeah.
But, like, you know what you're going to get here. You're going to get, anytime you have a dance scene with miners, you're going to get people cutting in to other people's dances, and it's just going to start a fist fight.
The Starfleets have to break it up, and Eve is just totally, like, not on board with anything that's going on here. She's sad, depressed. Like, she's still looking her best. She's not in blotch mode, but she's, like, she's really...
Ben, when I'm in blotch mode, I just don't even go to the party. I'll just stay home.
Yeah. Like, Kirk is looking at her like, I can't leave this woman here. Like, it's obviously, like, totally against her will. And when this fight breaks out, she, like, runs for the door and slips out. And, like, we're told that this planet is, like, SETI Alpha 5 levels of inhospitable, right?
Yeah, I mean, it'll season your cast iron pan out there. It's so, it's so crazy.
Yeah, so they, you know, they run out to try and catch her. Like, they do give her a little head start, very unnecessarily. and that head start is, I guess, enough that they're just not going to find her. But yeah, she's like, you know, she's running around out in this, like, sandstorm in a ball gown. The misery, the physical misery she's in perfectly matches the emotional misery she's in.
Yeah, well put. It's a real anybody canyon situation out there, Ben. Because
no
Kirk
kidding.
Is just screaming his head off at her, but she's unable to or unwilling to listen.
And Kirk is yelling for her, but eventually gives up. Surprising. Didn't think he believed in a no-win situation. I guess he goes back to the ship because he thinks that they can use sensors, potentially.
Yeah, which is another problem, right? Using those sensors is just going to deplete their remaining crystal power. And, like, I think it's funny and fun that no one pushes back on this. Like, they're searching for Evie using what little power they have. I mean, they've basically, like, put all their eggs in one basket. Like, they are
nobody
going to
nobody is
get
making the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few argument.
Yeah. Spock hasn't thought of it yet.
Yeah. I guess the miners have said, like, they've hidden all the crystals so that they won't be able to find them even if they want to. And I guess they have to take that seriously.
What? What's happening? What's all this?
I'm trying to save you.
What is this?
The, like, lead miner guy finds Eve and brings her back, puts her to bed. He wakes up the next morning and she's wearing one of his dress shirts and making him breakfast, but in a way that is not sexy or endearing.
No, they're sniping at each other like O'Brien and Keiko. Pretty safe to say they don't like each other. And
they've really, like, fast-forwarded through courtship and into, like, the 10th year of marriage here.
She does hip him to this sandblasted pan situation, which I thought, you know, if she didn't really have any affection for him, she wouldn't have shared.
Right. I loved that. Like that's such a great idea. Like, just from a script writing standpoint, like, okay, well, if it's true that there's, like, sandstorms all over this planet, let's write in a thing about how the pans can be cleaned by the sandstorms. Like, that's a pretty inventive little turn of story, and I really liked it. I like that it showed that she was, like, thinking about things on a really different level from him, too. He, like, you see it on his face that her cooking is amazing compared to his, but you also see on his face that she's thinking of shit that he never thought of, despite the fact that he's lived here for 3 years.
On the one hand, it accomplishes the thing that makes her look intelligent, but on the other hand, it's domestic intelligence and not,
right,
like, not any other kind, which might be less sexist.
Right. I mean, that scene made me wish more than anything we had had some interaction between these women and Uhura.
Right.
Or just some scenes with Uhura, like, expressing her take on the situation. Because, you know, she's there. She's a lieutenant in Starfleet. She's got a totally different outlook on her own life than these women who are either setting out to or being abducted into the idea that their highest destiny can be being sexy wives, you know. And Uhura's got to have thoughts on that, right?
I think we're holding this episode up to a standard that it could not possibly reach because, Ben, crucially, there is one credit on this episode that makes all the difference. It is Story by Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah.
And that is all you need to know.
So when Kirk and Mud come in and find that she's been rescued, she's kind of back to splotchy, and they give her one of the pills to take, and she takes it, goes back to beautiful, you know, goes back to slinking. And this is where Kirk kind of announces the moral of the story, which is there's only one kind of woman, and the force was in her all along. She didn't need the Schwartz ring to do the Schwartz.
Well, Mud kind of jumps in here, too, to share in the telling of that message. It's Kirk that begins by saying that it's about a woman, but it's Mud that says it could be a man, too.
Right.
You either believe in yourself or you don't. I thought a fun magic trick in this scene would have been if Kirk suddenly stopped believing in himself to demonstrate, and he just turned himself into Helmsman Buscemi.
So the moral of the story is really confidence is sexy.
Yeah. What a great message. I was not expecting that.
It's a great message told in the most misogynistic way possible. I could never have predicted that this is where Gene Roddenberry would leave us on this one, but I mean, like, I don't disagree.
That
I disagree with.
That had to be a punch up, though, Ben. Like, you know, Gene submitted the script, and the writers were like, "Look, we have got to tack something onto this." Like,
yeah, we can't just have it end with Kirk showing up with a gumball dispenser full of those pills and then leaving.
Yeah. Wow, that really is the line that I mean. You could argue that the line saves the episode from hell.
Right, yeah, from being, like, one of the most awful things ever aired on television.
Yeah. There's something paternal about the way Kirk giving this message, too. Like, what's...
Right, he kind of mansplains it to her. Like,
I would have expected Kirk to fuck his way through this entire group before arriving at this message, and he never does.
Yeah. Well, so, but, like, the way the message is revealed, like it's kind of what makes it not the perfect mate, right? Because the perfect mate, she is and stays the object of male sexual interest the entire time. And, you know, she is a rich and complex and interesting woman when she's attracted to Picard, and then she is diminished when she is attracted to the nobleman that she's being gifted to. This at least redeems itself from that. A little bit.
Pretty high bar there. The button on the story is that the lithium crystals deal is back on.
Yep.
And Helmsman Buscemi takes them out of orbit onto their next adventure.
I liked the little back and forth between Bones and Spock right before they depart the planet.
Yeah.
Where Spock says that he couldn't be more delighted that his internal organs are not in the same place as Bones.
God, this proto-Spock is really fun to me. I wonder if this is the version of Spock we're going to get in Discovery Season 2, like the groovy, chilled-out Spock.
Right, not quite as serious about everything.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, the Spock before Heartbreak.
High-grade ore, I've heard.
Did you like this episode, Ben?
Well, for all of the reasons aforestated, I did find it a little cringy. For the majority of it, I liked the end, I guess, a little bit. I didn't feel like it quite resolved whether these ladies wanted to be there at all. Not that it cared about them, but like the extent to which they are, you know, nobody cares about what they want. Like, it's an interesting artifact from a different time.
When they're given the chance to tell their own story, they talk about, you know, growing up alone and, like, doing work for brothers and family members or whatever. But it's unclear whether or not that's a true autobiographical history of their previous relationships, or if it's just pimping.
Right.
And I wish we knew that, right?
Yeah. And I like to get to see Mud, like the character that Rainn Wilson plays is, I think, a pretty different guy. Like, I think that the bigness and the dedication to never doing the right thing part of Mud is what they preserved.
Yeah.
Imagine like a contemporary reboot of this story. Like with like would anybody even sign up to do it? Would Rainn Wilson be okay with that?
Well, I think there's a way to tell the story and give the women agency. I think there's a way to do that.
Yeah, I guess I would be interested to see it. Maybe
Evie's struggling against the machine that they're in. Like Evie doesn't want to be there. She's able to articulate that.
But she does stay on the planet.
Yeah.
And we're never given any reason to believe she's like fallen in love with the miner guy.
Like, let's just think generically for a second. If we were breaking a story that involved a man who had scooped up three women and his...
I already went out.
And his mission is to take these women to be married to some strangers that they find along the way. You could, with only that amount of information, surmise that the man involved would be hostile to the women and they would fear him. Or
right.
There would be some sort of dark relationship that we see or would be implied. But I think it's very interesting in Mud's women how chaste the relationship is between Mud and them. Like, they don't fear him. Yeah. They kind of roll their eyes at him. They need the drug, but they don't, but it also isn't a drug that they need to live. It's just, and it's irritating when they don't have it. And I thought that was an interesting way to tell the story. Like, Mud is not an existential threat to them or the Enterprise, really. He's just a fucking problem and an irritation.
Right. It is weird that, like, so like, their entire value in this story is what they look like. And the potential, the, like, idea of husbands for them is entirely... Their value is entirely like how much money they have. Like, what is the business model? Does Mud like get? What do they pay him?
Well, for more on that business model, Ben, I will direct you to Two Shorts' album "Cocktails" and the lyric sheet inside. I think you'll find it very illuminating into how the pimping business works.
Okay.
W/R/T. How easy it may be. Or not.
I tend to prefer the works of Sugar Free,
right?
on this topic. I feel like he may even potentially have some practical experience in a way that is like fucked up as shit, but also oddly compelling.
One of the most fun random hangs that I've ever had with you was like us just drinking a lot of mezcal, going song for song sex rap against each other. Like listen to this song and how fucked up this is. And then we'll play a track and then you'd play another one. And God, that was crazy.
That was good times.
I didn't answer the question. I should probably do that, right?
I guess so, if you want.
I, like the other two original series episodes that I saw, liked this more than I thought I would going into it.
Yeah.
Hard to articulate why due to it, due to factors and reasons. But I think it just helps to go in with low expectations.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Do you want to watch the next Mud episode?
Oh, you're telling me there's more.
There's another Harry Mud episode from TOS called I, Mud. And I'm wondering if... Because I was expecting like the lady that he's always talking about in Disco to have like... to get a name drop in here. She seemed to be like an established idea of a person.
Mm-hmm.
And we even meet her in Disco, so I was kind of thinking maybe this like she would be a factor, but maybe not. I don't know. I was surprised she wasn't in here, so I kind of want to turn over the other stone and see if she's under that to satisfy my curiosity.
Let's do more stone turning, Ben. I'm into that.
Yeah.
My people were biologically determined for one purpose alone. to sense the coming of death.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to... oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
I have to sense the coming of death.
This doesn't make any sense.
I sense it coming now.
None of it makes any sense. It sounds like nonsense to me.
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
Yeah, I sure did. I mean, it's hard to choose against Helmsman Buscemi, but I will choose against him. Instead, I'll give my Shimoda to Spock for a very specific moment. It's the moment that... his job is sort of Riker-like in a way. Like, he's hospitality on the Enterprise, uh-huh. And so he's walked Mudd's women around the ship, finally taking them into Kirk's quarters. But then he has to walk them out. And like any gentleman, he lets the women leave first and then turns back around and looks at Kirk and gives that, "What the fuck are you going to do?" kind of shoulder shrug and head shake when he looks at him, which is like a very great shorthand for friendship. Like, if this is the third episode in the original series, there's a conspiratorial aspect to Spock and Kirk's relationship depicted already. Because right. You don't do that in a professional environment unless you're close. So I thought that was fun. What about you, Ben?
I'm going to give it to Mudd, you know? Like,
obviously, right?
He fills a lot of the qualifications for drunk Shimoda, and definitely the thing that I wanted to call out most is how bad of a liar he is in this episode. Like, he's kind of he's much more of a con man, much more like giving people information, you know, in a very strategic way, and then exploiting their misunderstanding of the entire picture later, kind of character in Discovery.
Yeah.
And a much more brutal villain in Discovery. But his inability to lie in a believable way was pretty fun. I think that's very of the time. You can't lie on screen and have it not be winking at the camera in the 60s.
You know, that's a great point. And for as shitty as Mudd is at that, it never really bites him in the ass. Like,
right.
You could argue that his plan didn't fail. He remained... flexible enough to see the thing through in a way that didn't make him into a complete buffoon. Like,
yeah.
There was never that moment where he utterly failed and was led away in shackles.
There were many opportunities, many times where, like, two guys with red shirts were standing by the door, overheard something that probably should have led them to just be like, okay, we're going to go run this up the flagpole and alert the captain about what just happened. But yeah, like the story lets him get away with a lot despite being terrible at it.
Yeah.
I also really liked the part kind of toward the middle of the episode where he broke into song.
Now you thought I was just 770 and 404. I'm wearing wide yet act like y'all know it's the abominable.
So that was pretty fun. I didn't know he had that much musical talent.
Yeah. I didn't know he could drive a race car that way.
What else do we need to do here on this episode, Adam?
We did what we came here to do. We talked about a TOS episode.
We did talk about a TOS episode.
Thus fulfilling the prophecy.
So I guess we can let Rob take it from here. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast, hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison, and it's produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our music is by Adam Ragusea. Head on over to MaximumFun.org to support the ongoing production of this show, or just leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to continue the conversation online, please use the hashtag GreatestDiscovery. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. You can also join in the discussion over at the Greatest Gen subreddit or the Greatest Discovery group on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.